This is the rehearsal speech for the Idaho Humanities Talk in Coeur d'Alene, September 15, 2005. Once upon a time, under a rising September moon, when I was a young hired hand on what passed for a farm in our rocky part of northern Montana, I squinted across the land where I was growing up and saw that the prairie had translated itself into a seascape. The wind was blowing, as it did day and night that summer, and the moving waves of rich yellow wheat could just be seen in the settling dark. A harvesting combine cruised on the far side of the field. I had never been within 1,000 miles of an ocean, but in the sudden shadow play of my mind, I could see that the combine, with its running lights just flicked on, was a ship bound through the night. Bench Hills rose to the north, surely a fair coastline. The expanse of it all, hills and fields and wind in the wheat, ran out far beyond, oceanic, to where the sky and the flat horizon fitted together. The magic of such remembered moments is indelible. I was 17, a restless kid farmhand with my nose in a book whenever I wasn't atop a tractor or a grain truck, there at that found sea which was both fictional and real to me. And now, with my whiskers gone white, I still write about both the green jigsawed Pacific Northwest coastline where I live now, and the rim of the prairie along that great mountain chain of the Rockies where I grew up. Probably every one of you in this room has places such as those, mapped into the soul, that never leave you. If you are lucky and can choose the where of your life, perhaps you do not ever leave some such place. And particularly here in the West, you are able to live within sight or reach of some piece of seductive landscape that seems to you the way the world ought to be. It sounds basic enough, doesn't it? The biologist E.O. Wilson theorizes that we have within us a deep biological orientation toward what he calls the right place. A landscape, he says, that evokes the setting of human early evolution in the African savanna. Wilson describes it as open, tree-studded land on prominences overlooking water. And that certainly sounds like home to me. So, I don't have much doubt that there is within us, perhaps particularly within those of us who have turned our backs on opportunities elsewhere and fashioned our lives to be in the American West, a longing for the right place. What I would like to think out loud to you about for the next little while are some points of the human compass that are perhaps beyond the true north or true west of behavioral biology. I have to offer myself and a few writing colleagues as specimens in this. I suppose writers are always doomed to be specimens of some kind. In a bit of exploration of the place we find ourselves in, here at the end of the country that is unmistakably not the Midwest, the South, nor back East. Time after time, contemporary writing about the West of America gets called a literature of place, a literature that seems to mean which focuses on a sense of the land, the overpowering geographic circumstances rather than on the mysterious soul of a people, as, say, the magical realism of modern Latin American fiction, or the deeply interior novels and poetry of Eastern European writing before the fall of the Great Wall of Communism, as those tended to look inward while we of the West are peering outward. Often our book titles themselves have seemed to say so. The Big Sky, Wolf Willow, A River Runs Through It. put them together right, you can make a kind of sagebrush haiku out of titles of Western literature. The critical notion, as I savvy it, is that the immensities of the West, its extremes of landform and its powerful weather, and the distances which flabbergast travelers from elsewhere in the world, these Western immensities overwhelm the fact of the people salt and peppered across the expanse. Place, in terms of landscape, backdrop of mountain and of plain and of hard weather, does figure large in the work of a lot of us who are trying to write about the West, but I don't particularly think it's at the neglect of the people, the human stories, the Westerners who carry on their lives against the big, bold landscapes of those books. Norman MacLean's fly-fishing brother of a river runs through it. No one who has read that story and has any imagination at all can wet a line in a trout stream without seeing, in the shadow on the water, Paul MacLean making his powerful, beautiful cast. James Welch's hard-used Men of the Reservations, Lame Bull and the never-named narrator of Winter in the Blood, and the dumb, shrewd hay hand they work with, Raymond Longknife. He had learned to give the illusion of work, even to the point of sweating as soon as he put his gloves on. Some of us here tonight have worked with that guy too, haven't we? The women of her family, whom Mary Clearman Blue writes of with such bone honesty in Balsam Root and other books, in their burdens, they are like those weathered but sturdy columns of Greek temples, sculpted in the form of a woman. They carry the sky for the rest of us. I'm going to come around again a little while from now to this matter of people we encounter in book pages leading everlasting lives in our imagination, because I happen to have a newcomer, tailor-made for tonight, I'd like you to meet. First, though, I think we need to take a closer look at this concept of place in the literature that marks our Western periphery of America. The shorthand notion that merely where we happen to come from on the map accounts for books and characters such as those I've just mentioned, and some more to come. That tends, as you can see, to make what hair I have left stand straight up. As in the very fine public television documentary Westwards a few years ago, when a reviewer noted that during my interview there on the screen, I seemed a trifle gruff, as he put it, when I pointed out that we're not just sitting around out here writing travelogues. This stuff is hard. To put it a little more judiciously here tonight, a geographic sense of place is a flavorful ingredient in Western literature, but let's don't think it's the whole supper. For there are other senses of place than the merely geographic, a bunch of them. The word place has so many meanings it takes up about 3.5 pages in the Oxford English Dictionary. And in my own desk dictionary that I instantly retreated to, 13 different definitions of place as a noun, a dozen usages as a verb. A word that sprawls all over the place, which is a phrase I didn't find anywhere amid all those definitions. And so, if we must pick and choose, as a writer, I favor the phrase, trying to place it. To place it, first in the sense of identifying, as my dictionary helps out here, to recollect clearly the circumstances or context of, as in the phrase, one that I've been known to resort to, I remember your face, but I can't place you. That's the first side of trying to place it in the literature of our region. And the next, trying to place it in the sense of putting something into place, setting, arranging, making it be where it ought to be. This is the carpentry part of writing, the craft, building a book the reader will want to live in, hammering together a solid basic structure, then taking care with the finishing work making sure you've got the details right. So, you bet, when we start following the paths of experience and craft, rather than the contour lines of maps, I do have my own senses of place, both as a writer and as a Westerner. And let me now try to bring out just a few of them. Begin with the beginning. I come from a place. I originate, as an American, from a place in a specific rural Western sense of the word. Another usage which doesn't seem to have reached the dictionary makers of Oxford and Boston. Place meaning an abandoned homestead. Small ranch or farm, either one, but abandoned, given up on, because of the killing winter of 1919 or the bank failures that rippled through Montana in the early 1920s or the Depression or World War II or death or disgust or any other of 100 reasons. I tried to explain this locally prevalent use in this passage of This House of Sky. By the time I was a boy, and Dad was trying in his own right to put together a life again, the doubt and defeat in the valley's history had tamped down into a single word. Anyone of Dad's generation always talked of a piece of land where some worn-out family eventually had lost to weather or market prices, not as a farm or a ranch or even a homestead, but as a place. All those empty little clearings which ghosted that sage countryside, just the McLaughlin place there by that butte, the Vinton place over this ridge, the Coons place, the Catlin place. All the tens of dozens of sites where families lit in the valley or its rimming foothills couldn't hold on and drifted off. All of them epitaphed with that barest of words, place. The Doig place in the Big Belt Mountains of south central Montana is where my Scottish grandparents seeded this family into America. My father, four of his five brothers, and his sister all were born on that homestead, the last of them in 1910, and being careful, slow-marrying Scots, most of them were around there off and on through the late 1920s and even on into the 1930s, the decade when I was born. Part of my own boyhood on ranches was within a few miles of that original Doig homestead. So, in my growing up, what history the family had was mostly of that place. By now, nobody has lived there for 60 years or more. Yet, it perseveres in me as my family's first step on the ladder called America. That homesteading experience, which did for the rural West what the tenements of the immigrant ghettos did for city America, provided landing sites, quarters to hold people until they were able to scramble away to somewhere else. That particular American saga, shared by my family and hundreds of thousands of others in the West, have given me impetus for much of my writing. To me, this is the story in the bloodline, the accumulating power of detail and speculation and wondering and questioning that pulsed in me from knowing of my own homesteading ancestors' hard work and harder knocks, and those of that ghost population, all those other places where families hung their names on the wind of time. When writers from Charles Dickens' London to Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities, New York, fuel their creative processes with such accumulated actualities, it is called drawing on what they know. When those of us with fence lines instead of Piccadillys and Wall Streets as our boundaries write about the territory we know, it tends to get called regional. One of the challenges, one of the whetstones of creativity for those of us writing out here is that the larger society has long had its own mythic notion of life out west. Whether embedded in celluloid or paperback pulp, that myth has compressed a large and complicated chunk of America into what I call as neutrally as I can put it, guys and their horses. Before the West began to hear from its first couple of generations of writers actually born and raised out here, literary tourists pretty much had their way with us. Books set out here on the west side of America didn't give that much attention to the workaday life and the valid voices of our region. A romantic version that one scholar called The Cowboys Without the Cows got underway at the start of the 20th century with The Virginian, Owen Wister's famous novel. The Virginian began a lineage of books that might be called Westerns. In a Western, a bad guy insults a good guy. If you look back in The Virginian, the actual insult is, "You son of a blank." Not much of an insult where I come from. The good guy, of course, dangerously drawls back, "When you call me that, smile." But that's about all that does go on in a Western. None of the guys, good or bad, seems ever to do a lick of everyday work. Milk a cow, churn butter, plant a potato. You get the impression that somewhere just out of sight, there must be a catering service, maybe someplace around Omaha, that comes out west, feeds everybody, does the chores. Back at the ranch at Yasnaya Polyana, I'm sure Tolstoy had his own uninvited ghosts to get past as he tried to write of his heartland. But those of us from the West, of women homesteaders, male school marms, the West of people who came to build rather than to gunsling, to work but to dance and laugh along with it, we've had to write our way past the Westerns and then the Westerns. Such stereotypes as the Virginian and then those later, heftier cohorts of his, Louis L'Amour and John Wayne. Now bear in mind, that was only yesterday, historically, when cultural images of the West were those two guys, with a pound of belt buckle trying to hold up 25 extra pounds of gut. Something had to give way. Blessedly, it has. In place of those Westerns and Westerns, we have a growing number of contemporary books where, as the historian Richard Maxwell Brown puts it, nemesis and tragedy, bitterness and beauty, and other universals of human life meet out here in the sage, the section line roads, and the wind-worn ranks of fence posts. Brown has singled out what he believes is an important grassroots autobiography and biography trend in contemporary Western literature. In his compendium, he discusses the role of This House of Sky and its companion, Hard Earth, so I'll blushingly skip over that part. But he lists several outstanding books of recent years that he thinks capture something distinctive about the West. William Kittredge's memoir, Hole in the Sky. Refuge by Terry Tempest Williams. Rain or Shine by Syra McFadden. Mary Clareman Blue's Baltimore, I've already mentioned, and she has another equally brilliant one, All But the Waltz. The list begun by Richard Maxwell Brown keeps lengthening itself. Teresa Jordan's Riding the White Horse Home, Kim Barnes' remembrance of coming of age in a logging family on the Clearwater River here in Idaho, In the Wilderness, the latest voice out of Missoula, Judy Blunt's book from last year, Breaking Clean, and just now coming into the bookstores, a compelling memoir by the Oregon novelist Craig Leslie about trying to connect with his coyote trapping poacher of a father, a great book called Burning Fence. Such grassroots works by born Westerners, Richard Maxwell Brown contends, constitute a meeting ground of the literary talent and the social history of the West. So, I think that's where a lot of us are continually trying to get to, from those rural home places we've known ever since, as our literary godfather Wallace Stegner once put it, our legs were long enough to reach the ground. But writers of quality also try to reach beyond that ground that gives them their foundation. Out there into the territory of trying to place the face of time and fate. To show us, through their words on the page, how our deep emotions connect with the map of nature, human and otherwise. There is career risk in this. A New York Times book reviewer once said of me that, as a novelist, I wear my heart on my sleeve. I don't think he intended it as a compliment, although I took it as one. But let me step aside from my own work and that of my contemporaries to illustrate what I mean about the great stakes involved in a writer trying to place something vital for us in the nature of things. Once there were two writers under one roof. It was a duplex, luckily. The promising young novelist Wright Morris and his wife Mary Ellen on the ground floor, and the young anthropology professor Lauren Isley and his wife Mabel directly above, there in a Philadelphia suburb in the last summer of World War II. The two couples clicked, sat on the porch in the evenings of that last pre-Hiroshima summer, drinking and talking. And myself having known Wright Morris slightly, I'm sure the talking was nimble. Most of my own conversations with Wright were of the written sort, but they were always barn burners from his end. If he hadn't sent me one of his scrawled postcards in a while, one would arrive with the explanation that the San Francisco Bay Area, where he lived the later part of his life, was short on ink due to an epidemic of fingerprinting. And his inscription in my copy of Photographs and Words, his remarkable photo and text book reprising the farmhouse scenes Wright shot when he went back to his home places in Nebraska in 1940, that inscription reads this way, word for word. Ivan, there is a kith and kinship between your house's sky and these earthly, unearthly objects which this occasion moves me to acknowledge. Can all this grandeur perish? No, no, I say no, no. Watch it drift out of sight. No, we can't do it. Fraternally, right. Lauren Isley, I never met, but I did hear him deliver a speech once. In a voice so eminent, deeply resonant, he sounded like God's older brother. You have to wonder about the nature of fate, the dice of chance, that ever threw these two together as inescapable neighbors and fortunate friends. They were both Nebraskans from childhoods with hard corners. Wright Morris's father was a drifter. Lauren Isley's mother was deaf and tormented. But there, all resemblances ceased. I can personally testify that Wright was antic, quick-witted, mischievous, adventurous. He used every dab of his life and travels in his writing, and he wrote a lot. 33 books, among them 19 novels and 3 memoirs. Isley, by all accounts, was melancholy, not particularly good with people, never went anywhere, a bleeder as a writer, and evidently as a soul. Wright Morris nicknamed him Schmertzy, short for Weltschmerz, world pain, sadness over the evils of the world, as we all learned back there in Philosophy 101. Onward they went in their careers, Wright Morris to literary prizes, the National Book Award in 1957 for The Field of Vision, a remarkable kaleidoscopic novel set in a bull ring in Mexico, and to the cusp of major literary reputation. With that quicksilver mind and a compositional hand almost as fleet, Wright Morris could write like an angel. Here are the opening sentences of his novel, The Works of Love. In the dry places, men begin to dream. Where the rivers run sand, there is something in man that begins to flow. West of the 98th meridian, where it sometimes rains and it sometimes doesn't, towns, like weeds, spring up when it rains, dry up when it stops. But in a dry climate, the husk of the plant remains. The stranger might find, as if preserved in amber, something of the green life that once lived there, and the ghosts of men who have gone on to a better place. But Lauren Isley, it turned out, Lauren Isley could write like an archangel, the recording one. This is the opening of the first story in Isley's best-known book, The Immense Journey. Some lands are flat and grass-covered, and smile so evenly up at the sun that they seem forever youthful, untouched by man or time. Some are torn, ravaged and convulsed like the features of profane old age. Rocks are wrenched up and exposed to view. Black pits receive the sun but give back no light. It was to such a land I rode, but I rode to it across a sunlit, timeless prairie over which nothing passed but antelope or a wandering bird. He goes on to tell of reaching the verge where that prairie halted before a great wall of naked sandstone and clay, and how there on that day on the long grass prairie of the middle of America he went down into a crack in the earth, a narrow limestone slit which, Isley realized when he had inserted himself into it, was a perfect cross section through perhaps 10 million years of time. Being an anthropologist, Isley writes next, I hope to find at least a bone. What he found instead, he tells us, was a skull embedded in the limestone. It was not human, some creature pre-human, Isley says, a low pinched brain case in the face of a creature who had spent his days following his nose and whose power of choice was very small. Although he was not a man, nor a direct human ancestor, there was yet about him some trace of that low, snuffling world out of which our forebears had so recently emerged. Under the prairie sky, Lauren Isley stares down at that skull. The skull stares, sightless, up at him. And Isley writes of that moment, this creature had never lived to see a man. And I, what was it I was never going to see? It is going to be hard for any of us ever to sum up the immense story of humankind better than Lauren Isley managed to in that single sentence. Two writers starting from roughly the same place, two careers of words for us to look back at. Wright Morris, whom I cherish personally, now looks like a cold, distant star there on the page. The technical brilliance, the sentences that one by one can be luminous, his books still always hold me to their surface. But the nature beneath, human or planetary, never quite comes through. Wright seems to have been listening to himself. Lauren Isley, by contrast, broody and withdrawn as he was, put himself and his inmost nature into facing his own fate in that place in the prairie. And I think Isley's words have lasted because he was willing to openly risk the feeling of mortality, the place in the heart that knows we are part of the long passage of things, there on the page, for himself and for us. If that little story shows what I think is the value of risk for a writer, sometimes going beneath and beyond the landscape for a sense of place, it's probably time I stick my neck out a bit and take you into the territory where the people of my imagination live. In my own work, when I counted up for a Washington Post article I was asked to write a year or so ago, about creating fictional characters, I found, somewhat to my dismay, that I'd employed 360 characters in 7 works of fiction at that time, all of them born and raised in the place between my ears. Since then, another 50 or so have formed up in my imagination and marched onto the pages of my next novel, The Whistling Season. In one of those, I'm going to briefly let loose from the pages into the room here. This will be an Idaho world premiere of a few lines of The Whistling Season, which won't be published until next spring. Because this character is right up the alley of life that has brought us all here tonight. When Rick Artinger called me up and asked me to make this talk on behalf of the Humanities Council, I should have just put this invented person, Paul Milliron, on the phone with him. Because Paul Milliron, in my novel, is a Western kid interested in roots, all right, but not simply the ones out in the root cellar of the homestead, or the ones his father has put down for the family in the homestead soil of the West in 1910. Paul is passionately interested in the roots of language. He starts being tutored in Latin after school in the one-room schoolhouse by an imaginative teacher whose lofty flights of thought Paul can only compare to balloon ascensions. Paul himself is drastically down to earth in his Latin translations. To him, noli exitari canis dormientis quite plainly means do not disturb the canines that are asleep, until his teacher shrinks it to let sleeping dogs lie. Highly literal as this schoolboy character is, it gives him one great advantage in the exploration of language. Whenever Paul is stumped by some fresh swatch of vocabulary or labyrinthine conjugation, Paul hears the echo of that long-suffering patient teacher telling him, look to the root. You must always look to the root of the word. As Paul puts it, it caused me to see into 2 languages at once. Fabula, story, and I gaped at the birth of fabulous and fable. Similarly, school from scala, recess from recedere. Suddenly, everything I read was wearing a toga. And so Paul, in my place here tonight, would have looked it up, wouldn't he? Humanitas, the root of our usage of humanities. In Paul's well-thumbed Latin to English dictionary, these several meanings of humanitas are given. Human nature, humanity, kindness, compassion, human feeling, courtesy, culture, refinement, civilization. Civilization. Do you hear it with me? That echo that still rings in those of us of a certain generation? The words spoken with a posh accent which, when we got past that, was loaded with astonishing learning? The BBC series on the history of art, majestically titled with that single word, civilization, was written and performed in front of our amazed eyes all those years ago by the English art critic Kenneth Clark. Inevitably, ultimately, Sir Kenneth Clark, Lord Clark. In its elegantly photographed journey through great paintings and cathedrals, that series was one of television's shining moments of the mind. There have not been that many. I've always figured television is called a medium because it's neither rare nor well done. But in Kenneth Clark, television found its Diogenes to take us through the world of art. And not incidentally, Clark's underlying strength was as a writer. The man had style, as reflected on the opening page of the memoir he ultimately wrote. My parents belonged to a section of society known as the idle rich. And although in that golden age many people were richer, there can have been few who were idler. What, you may well ask, does someone like that have to say to a scribbler like me, half a world away, and a legion of novelists and memoirists out here that the media back east get a kick out of calling writers of the purple sage. Quite a lot, actually, because Clark had a keen eye for artists far away from the self-appointed cultural capitals such as New York, London, Paris, the usual old suspects, who had the nerve to draw on their own roots and let their imaginations flower from that. Sir Kenneth was himself as inbred, upper-crust, snobby a Londoner as ever existed. But at the end of a centuries-spanning examination of great works of art, he concluded with characteristic lordly honesty, "Artists on the periphery introduce simplicity and common sense to a style that has become too embellished, too sophisticated, too self-centered, and they have a visionary intensity which at times attains a lyrical quality as they celebrate the world around them and strive to realize their fresh ambitions." The necessity of fresh ambitions. Kenneth Clark and I probably do not have a single thing in common other than that shared view of our respective fields, of how vital it is for a people, a society, a region, to have art, literary or otherwise, always making its way into our lives from new and unexpected directions. Which brings us back to Paul Milliron there at his dictionary, on his way to civilization by way of humanitas. I mentioned earlier the second side of trying to place it rightly for the reader, the craft side of writing, sometimes the crafty side. Writers aren't always up to all the tricks that critics think they're catching us at as we carpenter our books. Flannery O'Connor was asked once if she had put a black hat on a farmer in one of her Georgia stories to symbolize how mean the man was. And she said no, she did it because Georgia farmers wear black hats. Sometimes, though, in the making of a book, yes, the writer consciously resorts to some literary device or another that best seems to do the job for a particular scene. And for our last few minutes here, I'm going to share with you a trade secret underlying a moment when my character Paul is trying to place himself in his surroundings. It isn't much of a trade secret, or I wouldn't be letting you in on it, would I? But here it is. One thing writers sometimes do, there on the page, is to bring the emotional and the physical actuality together. The patron saints of writing have long shown us that this is something worth doing. Think of the great rhythmic nexus of experience and feeling that William Faulkner gave the fugitive Joe Christmas in Light in August. And Faulkner presents Joe to us, stepping from a dark porch into the moonlight, to flee from the beating he's just been given, staggering bloody and drunk into that Mississippi street. The whiskey died away in time, was renewed and died again, but the street ran on. The street ran into Oklahoma and Missouri and as far south as Mexico, and then back north to Chicago and Detroit, and then back south again and at last to Mississippi. It was 15 years long. It ran between the savage and spurious board fronts of oil towns. It ran through yellow wheat fields. To cut Faulkner short, which is always a shame but often necessary, the point is to try to get the writing to the frontier there on the page and in the reader's mind, where a character's circumstance is both physical and metaphysical. How to do that with my character Paul Milliron, back there in 1910, looking for places his 13-year-old mind can go? Paul at the time has no idea that by 1957, Sputnik's year, when he is telling this story to himself and us, he will be Montana's state superintendent of schools, with 1,000 suddenly beleaguered one-room schools under his jurisdiction. At this point of the book, Paul is looking back to that magical school year when he was a seventh grader and he and the other homestead kids daily ride horseback to the Marias Cooley School and pick up their horses to graze during the school day. That lofty-thinking new teacher, a male schoolmarm, has just arrived, and Paul's family is pitching in to ready up the teacherage out back of the school for him to live in. Paul, as always, is assigned to pump and carry water, and here he has just been sent off to fill the mop bucket at the pump in the schoolyard. It was late in the day, and the day was late in the season. The pewter cast of light that comes ahead of winter crept into the school ground as I performed the last of my water errands, shadows growing dusky instead of sharp, almost as I watched. From the feel of the air, night would bring our first hard frost. The schoolyard seemed phenomenally empty as I crossed it this time. I could distinctly hear my lone soft footsteps on ground that was stampeded across at each recess. Around at the front of the school, where the pump stood next to the flagpole, I slung the mop bucket into place under the spout, but for some reason did not step to the pump handle just yet. I suppose it was the point of life I was at, less than a man, but starting to be something more than a boy, that set me aware of everything around, as though Marias Cooley School and its height of flagpole and depth of well were the axis of all that was in sight. I remember thinking, if I wanted this moment for myself, I had better use my eyes for all they were worth. So, there in the dwindling light of the afternoon, I tried to take in that world between the manageable horizons. The cutaway bluffs where the Marias River lay low and hidden were the limit of field of vision in one direction. In the other, the edge of the smooth buttered plain leading to the town of Westwater. Closer, though, was where I found the longest look into things. Out beyond the play area, there were round rims of shadow on the patch of prairie where the horses we rode to school had eaten the grass down in circles around their picket stakes. Perhaps that pattern drew my eye to the other, the one I had viewed every day of my school life, but never until then truly registered. The trails in the grass that radiated in as many directions as there were homesteads with children, all converging to that schoolyard spot where I stood unnaturally alone. I think perhaps there, with that inquisitive Western kid reading the patterns in the prairie that lead to that solitary schoolhouse, where the book waiting for him inside on the dictionary stand surely has humanitas in it, is the right place to end up at tonight. Nurtured looking, enduring lessons in making the best of what you've got. And ultimately, in a last chapter of that trip I would not have dared to dream up as a fiction writer, that magic carpet of an airplane arced me over exactly where I started in life, the Two Medicine Country of Montana, with its blessed Bob Marshall wilderness below me, as familiar as the palm lines in my hand. To me, the true accents of those countries below were what their land says, what it has been caused to say in the patterns put upon it. If ever you have a moment of doubt about whether what you're embarking on here in this statewide brainstorming session about what Oregon might become from here, whether any of it really counts, think about it from overhead. The patterns we put on the ground around us do count. They are the story, the history, you will be read by. I don't know how many of you would have come here to this sustainability forum thinking of yourselves as storytellers. But in a way, that's what you're going to have to be to put across your sustainability ideas in your community, your business, in the Oregonian sitting next to you. You must find ways to talk to each other, to put yourselves and the person opposite you into a dialogue that holds both your interests. I urge you into a generosity of discussion and listening, of painting the walls of your civic dreams with words from your heart and soul. In short, in that oldest storytelling frame of mind, the one that comes from sharing light, the one that has been in us ever since art began to dance off the cave walls to us. Storytelling, writing, literature, civic assembly, remember, perhaps all begins there. In the painted bison running in the tunnels of time, the hunting escapades they represent being told around the fire. I think stories still can be our way of sharing light. Whether it's the white sheen of a page or the nebulae of cyberspace, sitting together around humanity's fire with the universal dark all around us. Every so often, I wish we could reweave time and bring forth a storyteller from his own neighborhood of history to an era where we need his particular eye and skill. Shakespeare, for instance, to write out the massive murderous idiocy of the trench warfare of World War I, which set the tone for the war-torn century just behind us. Joseph Conrad, to be aboard a moon voyage, tell us of the cold, boundless ocean of space. Jonathan Swift, perhaps, to do justice to the uncharted byways the internet is leading us to. But about the best I can do, I think his is the spirit of the long devotion to words and the fire and light they carry that must be kindled by you in your work for the Oregon you want, in the stories you hope to bring into being and to sustain. On one of the storied highways of the West, Riley, during his rambles of writing, pulls in to fuel up the Winnebago he's traveling. He notices beyond the gas pumps the usual sign, air and water. Before he can stop himself, he's out of the motorhome and over at that sign. And in the ancient, passionate compulsion to expand the story, he adds beneath in precise lettering, earth and fire.